It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here, reminding you to have a pencil and paper handy because there might be something you want to write down, a note you want to make, someplace you want to be sometime, somebody you want to send a letter or an email to. So have that ready and stay tuned for the news here. We'll start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team will be having a restoration this Saturday, February 8th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Yep, it's at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Well, the rain we had hoped for came, but not in any big way. It may be a little tough pulling, but we'll get the job done. We will continue with our broom bashing efforts, removing invasive non-native French broom. Come on out and give a little heart to nature. See you there. Once again, that's Saturday, February 8th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. How to get there? Go up Graham Hill Road out of Santa Cruz. Come down, turn right at the light. Go up East Ziandi Road a couple of miles, turn left Quail Hollow Road. And on the right, about a half mile up, is the park entrance. They will meet in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Do wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It might actually rain, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. Once again, that's this Saturday, February 8th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. And coming up is the 2014 Earth First Organizers Conference. And this notice sent out from the Everglades Earth First. They're excited to be hosting the Earth First Organizers Conference and Winter Rendezvous February 19th through the 24th. For those of you who attended the last Organizers Conference, remember how cold southern Iowa was? Well, don't fret. The 2014 OC will be held in the sunny subtropics in the swamps, the land of the alligator and the gar, the cypress, the slash pines, the area known by its colonizers as Florida, panthers, hand-sized spiders, bird-sized mosquitoes, sawgrass, palmettos, and pythons. It's the one and only Everglades. The scouts have chosen a location east of Lake Okeechobee. Directions can be found on the website. That is EvergladesEarthFirst.net. If you have a vehicle or need a ride, please visit the rideshare board on the webpage, whether traveling by car, bus, rail, airplane, foot, bicycle, canoe, sailboat, or hot air balloon. It may be helpful to travel through Lake Worth, the home of Everglades Earth First and the Earth First Journal, as many people will be carpooling from their airports in West Palm and Fort Lauderdale connect with Lake Worth by public transportation. Look forward to a wide variety of workshops, discussions, including and not at all limited to deep ecology, collective liberation, direct action, tree climbing, trans and or women's self-defense, fire starting, and digital security. This year we welcome children with a variety of workshops for kids, including plant ID and survival skills. We also have a pack list, what to bring and what not to bring. Please do not bring your dog, especially not your aggressive, unleashed, or unvaccinated dog. Organizers of the conference are not responsible for protecting your dog from the local gator population. Service animals are an obvious exception to the dog policy, though you might want to contact us ahead of time so we can let you know about other critters that will be at the OC with us. You can send them email at EvergladesEarthFirst@riseup.net with your questions, love poems, complaints, etc. Or visit the webpage www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net/EFOC2014. That's EvergladesEarthFirst.net/EFOC2014. And once again, the dates are February 19th through the 24th, somewhere in the swamps east of Lake Okeechobee. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. We sat waiting by the park border with the wind howling, the snow blowing. Several trucks with state and tribal hunters sat in waiting as well, only a few hundred yards from the northern border of Yellowstone National Park. 14 wild buffalo, 7 moms, and 7 calves faced the storm grazing and milling about. We waited, the hunters waited, then suddenly, inexplicably, the buffalo turned and ran away from the border, away from the hunters, away from the gut piles of their brothers and sisters killed over the previous weeks. They ran more than a mile deeper into the park where they rested, grazed, and slowly moved further away from the killing fields of Beatty Gulch. The scene, which we gratefully observed, repeated itself several more times over the past week. Buffalo approached the border with hunters at the ready only hundreds of yards away, only to turn back and head further into the park, leaving behind frustrated hunters who would go home empty-handed. Unfortunately, not all the hunters were foiled this week. 4 young bulls and the lead female of their family group were taken by, quote, harvesters, unquote, from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes just outside the park border. Another CKST harvester also killed an old bull that had been wandering alone in the Eagle Creek area. While I'm glad to report that only a handful of buffalo were killed this past week, I am sad to say that it was probably only a small reprieve for these most persecuted of North American wildlife species. The Nez Perce, the Confederated Umatilla tribes, and the Shoshone-Bannock tribes have yet to begin their harvest season in earnest. Many wild buffalo are now moving as they follow their ancient instincts from the deeper snows of Yellowstone's interior to the banana belt of the region, the Gardner Basin. Here they will go to find the grasses easier to reach, the landscape easier to move through. They will make obvious decision to go to areas where they will expend less energy and increase their chances of survival. Chances of surviving the harsh Yellowstone winter. The buffalo may be learning where it is safe to go and where the harvesters wait for them to cross the imaginary line with rifles at the ready. But as winter deepens and more buffalo enter the basin, they will inevitably cross that line in search of more grass and more room to roam. They will be killed, and when the tribal harvesters have taken their fill, the National Park Service, at the behest of the Montana Department of Livestock and the industry elites they represent, will capture the remaining wild buffalo. Many will be trucked to slaughterhouses by the very same tribes that have already taken too much from this last herd of wild buffalo. Some will be given to the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service to become subjects of cruel and inhumane experiments. Even in the midst of this tragic tale, beauty and hope abound. There's hardly a place in North America that is more spectacular and teeming with wildlife than the Gardner Basin. Eventually, wild buffalo will enjoy the freedom already shared by the multitudes of deer, elk, bighorn, sheep, pronghorn, antelope, eagles, ravens, and coyotes. Volunteers are needed. The intense field season is in progress. Buffalo Field Campaign invites you to join us in the front lines here on the edge of the world's national park, first national park, to help defend America's last wild buffalo. If you can spare a couple of weeks a month or stay with us for the rest of the season, we welcome your participation. The Buffalo Field Campaign provides room, board, gear, and training, while the wildlife and wildlands will provide incredible inspiration. Please visit our volunteer page to fill out the application, email our volunteer coordinators, or call area code 406-646-0. 0070 with your questions. Bring your passion and your ideas. See you on the front lines. You can contact or send a donation to the Buffalo Field Campaign at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. Do give them a call if you're planning to visit beforehand at 406-646-0070. And for all this information and more, go to www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. Here's the forest update for February from Jody Frediani, forestry consultant of the Lomia Prieta chapter of the Sierra Club and director of Central Coast Forest Watch. Some THPs for you. Peterson et al., THP 113-01-082, Santa Cruz. This 112-acre THP, or timber harvest plan, was submitted in September of last year. Joe Culver's the registered professional forester. The plan was circulated for 30 days on January 3rd to address marbled murrelet and fog drip issues. Close of public comment was February 3rd. Many public comments were received by CAL FIRE, but most pertained to safety concerns about log truck traffic on roads within and adjacent to a nearby subdivision. In a very unusual move, the plan may be recirculated for another 30 days to address issues regarding Townsend's long-eared bat, which was just listed as endangered 2 weeks ago, and a change in status regarding Bloom Grade Road. Neighbors and the plan submitters believe that the road is a private road. However, it has recently been determined by Public Works that the road is actually a county road that is not maintained. If further research confirms that Bloom Grade Road is, in fact, a county road, this will lead to a different set of mitigations and require recirculation if it is to be used as a haul route. However, Rich Sams and Cal Fire thinks that hauling through the subdivision and bypassing Bloom Grade Road is a better environmental choice. Neighbors may not agree. Jody suggested that Cal Fire hold a public meeting so neighbors can be informed of the changing situation and air their concerns. Rich Sampson of Cal Fire agreed that Cal Fire would probably consider such an idea, but would need to get the request as soon as possible from the county. If you have an interest in seeing such a meeting, contact Supervisor McPherson's office immediately. That number, 831-454-2200. I understand that Matt Johnson, county review team member, would make the request, but he needs to be directed to do so by a supervisor. Another timber harvest plan, this one on Hester Creek, plan number 1-14-009, SCR, and it's Palfrey et al. Timber harvest plan. This newly submitted timber harvest plan along Hester Creek is in the Soquel Creek watershed. The plan identifies the location as approximately 3.5 miles northeast of the town of Scotts Valley. If that disturbs you, I suggest you write a letter to Cal Fire that the plan be re-noticed using the distance from the town of Soquel, which is downstream to locate the plan. It's not anywhere near Scotts Valley. Hester Creek is a perennial stream that defines the western boundary of the plan area. The plan is 58 acres. The registered professional forester is Joe Culver. This THP was submitted to Cal Fire and posted on their FTP site on January 31st. It has not yet undergone first review and thus has not yet been accepted for filing. Here's another timber harvest plan at Grizzly Flat, THP 112-107 SCR. This 130-acre plan submitted by the city of Watsonville continues to be under review. Joe Culver, the RPF. The THP is located within the Corralitos Creek Planning Watershed, considered habitat for both steelhead and coho salmon. The pre-harvest inspection was held on December 12th. No second review team comments have yet been posted. Pre-harvest inspection reports from Cal Fire, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the California Geologic Survey can be found on Cal Fire's FTP site. And Santa Cruz Land Trust has submitted a non-industrial timber management plan, 1-14-NTMP-002-SCL-SCR, known as the Star Creek NTMP. This non-industrial timber management plan was posted by Cal Fire on January 30th of 2014. It has not yet undergone first review and thus has not yet been accepted for filing. The plan is 341 acres split with approximately half in Santa Clara County and half in Santa Cruz County. Pescadero Creek borders the eastern edge of the plan area. It is located 3 miles north of Aromas. Bill Vaughn is the registered professional forester. And the International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, or the IUCN, has upgraded the listing of the Coast Redwood Sequoia sempervirens from vulnerable to endangered. The famous redwood forests form a very distinctive lowland coastal vegetation type dominated by the tallest of all trees. The altitudinal range, 1 to 750 meters above mean sea level. Though pure stands of sequoia are not uncommon, especially at low altitudes on river flats near the coast, mixed stands of both conifers and angiosperms are more the rule. Most common among the associated conifers are Tsuga menzenzii, Tsuga heterophylla, and Erebus grandis. Most frequent angiosperm trees are Acer macrophyllum and Lithocarpus densiflorus. I have no idea what those are, probably Douglas fir and other things. Especially hilly terrain of upland sites, many other tree species can be present, and sequoia often becomes a lesser component of the forest. The autoecology of this species is remarkable for its capacity to resprout after damage at all levels up the tree, but especially from lignotubers forming massive, largely subterranean swellings. Evidence of fire in old-growth redwood forests attests to its adaptation to such disturbances mainly in this manner. Many trees have formed several large stems around an old burnt stump. We, of course, know those as fairy rings. Longevity has evidence from ring counts on bowls exceeding 2,000 years, but this may on account of be of the survival strategy may be substantially longer. The occurrence of frequent oceanic fog and the interception of this moisture through branchlet deposition, phyllotaxis, and leaf shape in the crowns of especially old-growth trees are apparently crucial to species survival in this otherwise summer-dry region. Its distribution and inner limit of 61 kilometers represents the inner limit of the fog belt, and that's from that petition of Coast Redwoods. And fungi in the forest from the California Forest Stewardship Program. This lengthy article provides a refreshing perspective. The bottom line is we wouldn't have forests without fungi. Here are a few tidbits to pique your interest. 90% of the forest soil biomass, the weight of all living things, is not including roots, is fungi. These tiny organisms can grow to many acres in size and thousands of tons in weight. Several miles of filaments or hyphae can be present in less than a thimble full of soil associated with vigorously growing plants. A single plant may be associated with dozens of species of fungi. Some mycorrhiza can connect many individual plants and trees, moving life-giving water and nutrients around the forest. And we want to thank Jody for her monthly updates. Jody Frediani is the forestry consultant for the Loma Prieta chapter of the Sierra Club and the director of Central Coast Forest Watch. And the whaling fleet is approaching Australian and New Zealand waters in this story from Sea Shepherd Australia. Yushin Maru number 3, the harpoon ship responsible for hitting the Bob Barker during last Sunday's 9-hour assault on Sea Shepherd ships, is currently approaching the waters of the Australian Whale Sanctuary. It is the second time this year that the ship has threatened to enter Australian waters, tailing the Sea Shepherd's long-range ship, the Bob Barker. At the same time, the Japanese government security vessel, Shonan Maru No. 2, responsible for the sinking of New Zealand-registered trimaran 80 Gill in 2010, is heading for New Zealand waters. The vessel is currently tailing the Sea Shepherd ship, the Steve Irwin. At its current course and speed, the Yushin Maru No. 3 will enter the 200-mile nautical limit of the Australian Whale Sanctuary surrounding Macquarie Island at 2000 hours Australian time February 8th. The Shonan Maru No. 2 is due to enter New Zealand waters at 0200 New Zealand daylight time on February 8th also. On January 10th, the Yushin Maru No. 3 stopped short of Australian waters following a formal request from Sea Shepherd to the Australian Environment Minister Greg Hunt, requesting his intervention on the matter. If the harpoon ship enters the Australian Exclusive Economic Zone, it runs the risk of contempt proceedings as a result of the Japanese whaling fleet's continued defiance of the 2008 Australian Federal Court, which ruled the Japanese whaling fleet's operations were in violation of Australian federal law. Captain Peter Hammerstedt of the Bob Barker says, during Sunday's attack, when the Yushin Maru No. 3 slammed the full weight of its steel vessel into the bow of my ship, I saw the reckless desperation of an archaic and brutal industry struggling to survive. The shameful operations of the Japanese whaling fleet have no place in the 21st century, and this blood-stained harpoon ship has no place in Australian waters. In June 2013, New Zealand joined Australia to challenge the legality of Japan's whale hunt in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary at the International Court of Justice, a ruling the case is expected imminently. On January 6, 2014, New Zealand's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Murray McCulley, released a statement that, quote, condemned the resumption of so-called scientific whaling in the Southern Ocean, unquote, stating the New Zealand government has repeatedly called upon Japan to end its whaling program. Unquote. According to United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, ships that enter a nation's territorial sea can enjoy the right of innocent passage through the territorial sea. Captain Siddharth Chakravarti of the Steve Irwin says, the passage of the Shonan Maru No. 2 is anything but innocent. This vessel has intentionally collided with and consequently sank the 80 Gill, endangering the lives of crew on board both vessels. The entire purpose of this ship's operations is to provide security to an illegal operation. They are no different than armed thugs protecting drug-running operations. Under no circumstances should this ship be permitted to enter New Zealand's waters. Sea Shepherd Australia has once again contacted Minister Hunt, requesting his intervention to stop the Harpoon vessel from entering Australian waters. Further, Sea Shepherd has contacted Minister McCulley, requesting that New Zealand enforce their 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone and deny entry to any whaling vessel into New Zealand waters. The Japanese whaling fleet is operating in the Southern Ocean in violation of the 1986 global moratorium on commercial whaling and in contravention of the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary established in 1994. For more information, go to www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And the Idaho wolf hunt ends. The hired gunman has been halted. Faced with a looming court deadline to defend its actions against a suit by the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies, Idaho's Department of Fish and Game halted its wolf extermination program in the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness. Nine wolves had already fallen to a hired hunter-trapper who began killing wolves in December. It's unknown how many animals remained alive in the two targeted packs. The Center for Biological Diversity sued the department and the U.S. Forest Service, which was assisting it, arguing that the wolf killing program prioritized elk numbers for human hunters over wilderness values. After a federal judge rejected our request to stop the program on January 17th, we took our fight to the Court of Appeals, filing an emergency request for an injunction January 23rd. It's a tragedy that nine wolves had to die before the state of Idaho finally pulled the plug on its needless effort to eradicate two whole wolf packs from one of America's largest wilderness areas, said Noah Greenwald, the center's endangered species director. The wolves were only playing the role they play in nature and should never have been killed. It shouldn't take court action to stop such cruel, unnecessary, and wasteful killing, but I'm glad it has stopped. And 2,500 wolves have been killed in the northern Rockies and Midwest since 2011. In a grim glimpse of how wolves will fare across the country if Obama administration goes ahead and drops federal protections, 2,570 gray wolves have now been reported killed by hunters and trappers in the six states where the protections were eliminated in 2011 and 12. Since then, states have sponsored aggressive hunting and trapping seasons, and roughly half the known population of wolves in the lower 48 states have been killed. So far, 915 wolves have been killed in Idaho, 566 in Montana, 130 in Wyoming, 562 in Minnesota, 374 in Wisconsin, and 23 in Michigan. The death totals are in addition to wolves killed by agency staff over wildlife conflicts and wolves killed by illegal poaching. Scientists estimate that when Europeans arrived on the North American continent, as many as 2 million wolves roamed the landscape. As settlers moved west, the livestock industry refused to coexist with wolves, and the animals were all but eliminated from the lower 48 states. If this senseless slaughter doesn't convince the Obama administration that we need to reverse course on plans to drop wolf protections, the bloodbath will go on, said Amarok Weiss, wolf advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. And 50,000 people have spoken out against Georgia's rattlesnake roundup. The center has long stood up for the right of all kinds of critters, even creepies and crawlies that live free and wild, including eastern diamondback rattlesnakes. And a few parts of the South are still persecuting the feared snakes via brutal rattlesnakes roundups that involve capturing and butchering rattlesnakes and hurting all other kinds of native animals in the process. But Georgia has been good enough to listen, switching from roundups to wildlife festivals, all except in one little town. Wiggum in southwest Georgia still clings to its outdated rattlesnake roundup, which encourages locals to catch as many of the rattlesnakes as possible, often by pouring gasoline into their burrows, and then sell them at the roundup for their skins and meat. So before Wiggum's roundup recently occurred, we rallied wildlife supporters against it, delivering a petition boasting more than 50,000 signatures calling for an end to the town's totally unnecessary animal cruelty. Eastern diamondback rattlesnakes are in rapid decline, and the center has petitioned to protect them. And you can find more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And wilderness wins. The road through the Izembek Wilderness has been rejected in this story from Wilderness Watch. In a great victory for wilderness, on December 23rd, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell rejected a proposed land exchange and 20-mile road through Izembek Wilderness in Alaska. The contentious proposal had placed at risk one of the nation's premier wildernesses and the rich wildlife it supports. Secretary Jewell's decision supported a February 2013 U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recommendation. In its final environmental impact statement, the agency announced its preferred action to reject the road and land exchange. Unfortunately, on January 15th, Senator Mark Begich of Alaska introduced legislation to approve the road and land exchange. We'll keep you posted. For more information, go to www.wildernesswatch.org. And West African lions are threatened with extinction in this story by Emma Farge, editing by Andrew Heavens of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. West Africa's lions, which once prowled across the region in the tens of thousands, are close to extinction as farmland eats up their ancient habitats and human hunters kill the animals they feed on, a study has shown. Just around 400 of the animals were thought to have survived across 17 countries, according to the paper published in scientific journal PLOS One. These lions are standing on a cliff looking at the chasm of extinction, Luke Hunter, one of the paper's authors and president of wildcat conservation group Panthera, told Reuters. It would be very easy for small isolated populations to be wiped out over the next 5 to 10 years. Fewer than 250 of the survivals are mature cats, capable of breeding, the study said, and even if that ability to produce cubs was limited by the fact that they are spread across wide areas and groups that often do not have enough lionesses to support a population. The study said that there's been no comprehensive study of the size of past populations, though Hunter said there would at one stage have been many thousands of lions. The study led by Panthera said they were now only present in 1.1% of their original habitat and recommend they should be classified as critically endangered. Conservation efforts in a region known for its poverty and political instability have been weak compared to other parts of Africa, and the population density is about 15 times lower compared with lions in East Africa, the study said. Parks in the region typically had 4 staff or fewer per 100 square kilometers, it's added. One of the main reasons for the decline was the conversion of habitat into farmland. Others included sharp falls in the number of antelope, buffalo, and other prey, and villagers killing lions in revenge for the loss of livestock. It's become very complicated for this carnivore at the top of the food chain to find enough space and food to survive, said Hunter. The West African lion, a relatively slender animal with a thin mane, is genetically distinct from the rest of the African species. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM or at www.freakradio.org. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to KRFP Monday nights at 9:30. Their frequency is 90.3, their new high power frequency, though they're currently at 42 watts. Or if you want to download and listen to a podcast of this radio show, tune in to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. And you can find Earth First Update listed under Earth First Radio News. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next time for another edition of the Earth First Update.